What's up? I'm not going to sweat it with Mark Pollard. I'm in Hell's Kitchen going on a walk and talk. I haven't done too many of these recently, maybe in the past year or two. A few reasons, I guess, but usually if I don't do these, my head's just in everywhere else. So, the start of this year, 2024, we've had events in London, did three events, two live streams, and one in-person event. I'll talk briefly about that. Got the Accelerator. 4 week accelerator starting in a few days, which is my favorite program. Thinking about whether we do it three times this year, but we'll at least do it in March and October. Summer camp, master classes, just trying to work out all the rules for everything. I just ate at one of my favorite little Korean spots in Hell's Kitchen. It's kind of west of the main spot or main part of Hell's Kitchen towards like 10th Ave. And what I'm going to do is going to walk from there. It's called Bulbap Grill, actually. I just had a quick chat with the owner. He's got this cool little space that isn't used and has had a different restaurant name connected to it. If you could imagine, it's the size of like bedroom. Could probably fit, if it had small tables, 15 people in there, maybe 10, let's say 10. It's not used, and I walk past it so often, eat there. I was like, could I film it there? And so I started to talk to him about that space, and now in my come up with some ideas, because as many of you would know, Korean culture is massive, and if you have a good concept that's very Instagram friendly, you will get a lot of Koreans at the very least, or Korean interested people there, even though it is like two blocks from the Hudson. For those of you in New York, obviously the way that the New York mindset works is uptown and downtown, not north and south, it's east and west, not left and right, which is probably not a thing that people do. And the avenues can feel very, very wide in the winter. Today's quite warm. It's a Wednesday. I got a t-shirt and a coat on. So yeah, if you have ideas, what would you do if you owned a Korean restaurant that had a little space for another restaurant next to it? What kind of concept would you put in there? It is a weird kind of area in that it gets a bit quiet. So 9th Ave. I hope I get all the numbers right. I often make mistakes with numbers and names and spelling things. And I'm studying languages, which I'll also talk about in a second. So my brain is a little bit like, oh my God, what language am I speaking right now? 9th Ave is the busier part of Hell's Kitchen. We moved here 13 years ago. It's nicer now. I don't mean that in a pro-gentrification way, although I guess I do. Or do I? I don't even know. There's just more interesting stuff here. I feel like there's more competition with the food. Oh, because we have such good Asian food in Sydney, big Asian population, a lot of my mates back there come from that region, or their folks do. I often, not necessarily judge, but well, yeah, I guess I kind of judge some cities on if they have any good Asian food. And I have to admit, for the first few years in New York City, I found especially Thai food not that good, especially compared to Sydney. I still remember going to certain Thai restaurants in Sydney back in the day. I was just like, oh my God, this is incredible. Not that it was my first time having Thai at all, but in those restaurants, just there was this explosion around Newtown, King Street down into Enmore. Got to be 23 years ago. I don't know. And I was just like, this is incredible. So yeah, 9th Street's a little bit busier. I'm just coming up to it now, which is why I'm talking about it. You'll hear some noise. Hopefully it won't be too loud on the microphone. It is raining. So I don't know if water is going to get on the microphone as well, but I'll take us to Times Square. Get you to listen to that and talk through some Instagram posts and including, it's funny. The internet's hard right now, but I'll talk about the Taylor Swift conspiracy as a strategy. I'll talk about creative teams, working with them. There's another little topic I'll get into as well. And the way that I'm approaching this particular walk and talk, although I've been doing it a little, is just looking at the Instagram posts that get a bit of traction, and then I'll work out how to speak through them. Super weird, because 3 to 4 years ago when I started to do walk and talks, I had asked for questions via Instagram or Twitter or whatever. I'd get sometimes get like 50 to 60 in the space of an hour or two. Now, everyone's a bit quiet. Maybe they're tired, sick of it. They've had all their questions answered. I've seen murmurs about how people are liking posts and interacting with things less. They're burnt out, or they don't want to reward the creator, or they're worried about people seeing, could be a boss or a partner, seeing what they're liking. or they're worried about the algorithms just knowing them too well and then just flooding them with the same stuff. So it's weird times out there, for what it's worth. I've been on LinkedIn for ages. It's so hard to get reach right now. I don't know. You keep hearing about people being in pods, 100 people in a pod, posting things and then liking each other's stuff. It's not a new technique. I've never been involved with that. I've never bought followers. But LinkedIn's difficult. Twitter for us. And shout outs if you work at Twitter and you're listening to this or X, because I love you. But it's pretty much dead for our industry, unless you want to reach 100 people. Or maybe a few thousand. Facebook, really tough. No, we've got nearly 20,000 people in our group there. Very hard to even get in front of the people who do use Facebook anymore. TikTok, if you start on TikTok, hard to scale. Helps to be young and attractive and have your body parts out, you know that. Instagram, up and down, it comes and goes. Seen all kinds of stuff going on there. Briefly talk about events, and I'll get into some useful, well, not events, but this stuff that's been going on in life and the world, and not the world, my life, sweathead life. I wanted to do one of these in London, but my mood just fell off a cliff. It just went off. And I know that when I'm doing talks overseas or organizing events, whether they're events in New York, online or overseas, that for 2 to 4 weeks before them, I get quite anxious. It's just in me. You know, I'll notice I'm waking up at a weird time. It's like 4 a.m. and I can't get back to sleep. Not as bad as things used to be for me. I've spent a good 20 years struggling with sleep, but now I'm mostly okay. A big part of that is because I'm lifting heavy weights. About 10 years ago, I was doing the 5x5 strong lift program, which is old school. It's not about looking big or having big muscles. It's just about getting strong. You do very heavy squats 3 times a week and you put up the weight every single time, let alone deadlifts and bench, etc. And then last year and a bit before, I was doing this PHUL thing. And now I'm doing a slightly different version. And I found that as soon as I start to get momentum, that my central nervous system gets exhausted. And I have to admit, sometimes I'm 3 or 4 hours into my day, so I might go to a cafe at 8 or 8:30. By 12, all of a sudden, my body's just wanting to like sleep. Now, two things that I'm adjusting to, actually, is one, when I did go to England, I took a week off training, stayed in this hotel around Bayswater. It's kind of a dead area when I was there. London didn't have the energy I was looking for, to be honest, when I went. It was a bit grim. And I know just after I got back, a recession was announced, but I was hoping for some, you know, vibe and benefits from London. I'll be back. But I took a week off, went back to the gym, and then put all my weights up, 10 pounds, which is about 4 kilograms each, and did them all. Completed all the reps, all the sets. And so I did that again. Actually, I did that a few weeks before, after we went to Dominican Republic. Same deal. So I'm thinking maybe every 4 to 5 weeks just to take a week off. I found that the body was coming back less tired, more motivated. Now, the risk is you fall off, but generally I was coming back more motivated, feeling good. And less of the little, the niggles. That, by the way, that is one of those words you don't hear much in the US, and you can imagine why. It's niggles, as in like little pains here and there. We sometimes use it in sport, that you're niggling at somebody. I'm not trying to attempt the other word, don't worry. But it's one of those words that you don't hear a lot. So niggling or needling could be where, say, you're playing a sport and you're just trash talking a little bit. So a pain in the joint is like a little niggle. But anyway, I found that they mostly cleared up. So London was good. We did 2 live streams. Big thanks to all the speakers. I thought they were great. I had a few surprises with all the organizing of it. So apologies if that affected you in any way. For example, Google Calendar sent out something like 200, 250 emails to a lot of people. And I don't know why. There's no setting. I was asleep. There's no setting saying spam people 250 times. I have no idea what happened. I think it just overloaded because we had 2,000 RSVPs. And then I had to delete the event, hoping that people would still know to come, because I think Google was just, Google Calendar was just freaking out. And then had a couple of surprises just for the general production and organizing a live stream for the day. So I was scrambling for a week or two to try to find someone and somewhere to potentially do it. Although Adam and Eve were very kind to host us. And the experiment for me was like, can we go there, do a really good live stream? And then could the content be useful later? Execution, I give myself a lot of the stuff I do. I give myself maybe a 5 or 6 out of 10. But I thought the speakers were great and the content was really good. So, you know, most people are pretty, not appreciative. What's the word I'm trying to find? Accommodating. It was great. I think the larger sessions had maybe 600 people or 700 people come through, which is good. So big thanks to everybody for that. And then we had did a masterclass as well. Sold out. It was great. 40 people. No more space at the Museum of Brands. A bunch of people flew in from Czech Republic and Germany. It was good. I just felt rushed that whole week, though, and I was hoping to spend a bit more time with people, but couldn't. I also got to catch up with some friends. I think Vicky Ross, you might listen to this, so thank you for coming out. Dude was super drunk at 5 p.m. Don't know what that was all about. London, God, Jesus Christ. Alcohol. This is like regular dudes falling over on the street on Fridays and Saturdays, like 3 p.m., 4 p.m., 5 p.m. And it's winter. It wasn't even like the season where all the Scandinavians were going to come in and do that. I'm joking. You know what I'm talking about. Took myself to a comedy club. I usually do that when I travel, if I can. It was okay. It was good. The guy who closed it actually closed the last and only other comedy event I've ever been to in London about 4 years ago. At that one, there were four people up the front. Of course they were from Essex. Don't be racist. Of course they were from Essex. And they tried to get in a fight with the comedian who was also the security guard and quite a large guy. They were smashed. Guy behind me, total arrogant English, you know, posh dude, drinking a bottle of champagne out of the bottle of champagne. You know what he said to me? I sort of engaged him briefly in a friendly way, usually pretty friendly. And he goes, are you some kind of like IT developer? And I was like, bro, what does that even mean? Why is that the thing you got to pick? Okay, I'm at West 47th Street, right at Times Square. I can see Times Square right now. I don't know, that might excite a few of you. I think it's a special place. A lot of the cool advertising people, the young people, they're like, I don't go above 14th Street. I like to walk through Times Square, man. Like, it blows me away. I still remember when I moved here 13 years ago, kids were 3 and 5 years old at the time. Sachi and Sachi put us up for a couple of months right near Times Square. And I just bring them out and go, hey, we're here. We made it here, you know? Could we make it anywhere? I don't know. But we did make it here and we're still here. We'll talk about New York again some other time.
Hey, it's the human.
Because, you know, Georgia's on my mind. The country, not the state. Turkey. No, you're doing it tough, by the way. All these countries doing it tough. Everyone's doing it tough. What else? Duolingo. Let me do like 2 or 3 personal topics, then I'll get into the strategy stuff. I'm 102 days, I think, straight on Duolingo. I'm crushing Spanish. I'm trying to finish the A1 part of it probably by the end of this month. So that'll be about 4 months to get through A1. I'm not doing enough like listening and talking exercises, so I gotta fix that. But some of it's sticking decently. The brain does feel overwhelmed and all of a sudden, you know, you might go for a walk and go, oh, I remember that word, and this is how I would say that. And if you speak at about this pace with A1 words, I will probably understand 60% of them. I made that up, but that's what I'm thinking. It's been good. It's been good. I enjoy it. Had to unlearn some of the French rules for those to speak French. Pretty fluently. In London, I spoke to a guy in French for 2 hours. I was like, I still got it. I love it. Listen to a ton of reggaeton. Oh my God. And reggaeton is one of the best words to practice your trill on. Reggaeton. And Duolingo is funny because you learn things like this, you know. I'll get this wrong. I better get it wrong. Las vacas limpiaron la sala, pero los perros no limpiaron el dormitorio, which means the cows cleaned the living room, but the dogs didn't clean the bedroom. You learn these phrases which I kind of like. And but one thing that's tricky, and I think in a good way, Russia doesn't like it, but one thing that's tricky is Duolingo will deliberately mess with the genders of things. So they'll have one of the female characters saying stuff like, you know, I need to go to the restaurant to meet my wife. And if you're not careful, you're looking for the word husband because you're sexist. We have, I don't know whether it's gender or sexuality issues. I'm joking. Although, because of all of this, Russia is, I don't know, they're not suing them, but they're trying to, they're doing something to Duolingo about promoting LGBTQ rights because of all that. But I tell you what, this is my point of view. If you do Duolingo and you turn out a little bit gay, maybe that's okay. Or you need to get a sex change because you did Duolingo. Maybe that's just what life has in store for you anyway. I don't think it's going to force it upon you. Gosh. I don't usually talk so freely and cheekily about some of these topics, but it's a bit ridiculous out there right now. Okay, so we just go through Times Square quite quickly. It is raining, so it's a bit quieter. And I was walking through quickly. Yeah, reggaeton's really good. Love Bad Bunny. Oh my God. Can you do anything wrong? Rosalía, Si Tangana, Rao Alejandro. So good. When it comes to Brazil funk, MC Bin Laden, he's still my guy. And I know that name's a bit awkward. He's still my guy. And I have to tell this story so often. I try to tell it all the time. But when I was at Hacktown in August last year and Santa Rita do Sapucaí, I stood next to MC Bin Laden. It was very late. I didn't like his name. I'm an old school rap guy. But I was like, oh, do you have to have this name? What are you doing? But I like drunkenly took a photo kind of next to him. He was getting interviewed on television. So I was next to him, but he was getting interviewed. Put it that way. Big shout out to the crew at Hacktown. Another awesome event coming up this August. Mostly in Portuguese, probably 99% Portuguese. If it wasn't, you should go. And I was not vested in liking this guy, MC Bin Laden. I was not at all. And then at about 1 a.m., 2 a.m. in the backyard of one of these houses, it's called the House of Hocamboli. They say R with an H, so Rodrigo would be Rodrigo. House of Hocamboli, which is like a cool music label. MC Bin Laden, he goes on stage. There must have been 1,500 to 2,000 people, I don't think more. But the backyard of this place was packed. And everyone went off, and I was like, oh God, I think I like this music. And usually when I do events in other countries, I try to play a little bit of Brazil funk or reggaeton. See, it's just so good for the trill. Reggaeton. Anytime I'm not feeling confident about speaking Spanish, if I'm by myself, I just try to say reggaeton. I'm like, oh, I've got the R coming. It's coming. Yeah, MC Bin Laden. And now he's on Big Brother in Brazil, so he's turning into this massive star. I wasn't really sure about that as a move for him, but I think it's going to do well for him. And the music that his crew's been putting out, he's got a good crew around him, I'm pretty sure. But the music that he's been putting out is still pretty, it's still pretty Brazil funk. And for those of you who don't know, there is a subgenre, I think it's a subgenre called putaria, which works in Spanish and Brazilian. And it's literally just sex rhymes. If you go to YouTube and you look up Brazil funk, you'll see this documentary. We'll look up Brazil funk documentary. You'll see a documentary made by a couple of girls. I think they're Brazilian. And one of the main characters, it lost steam for me towards the end, but one of the main characters is this, I've forgotten his name, maybe 12, 13-year-old boy. He's a little bit chubby, which is relevant to the story. And obviously he's got adults producing him, and he apparently performs like 20 times a week. And it's just sex rhymes. He's like telling you what he's going to do to you. And the whole crowd, which is all the genders, they're just like, yeah. And then he'll be wearing like a tank top, or if you're in Australia, a singlet in the US is one of those wrestling onesies. So if you say you're out on the weekend wearing a singlet, people will laugh at you. It's a fun. But yeah, part of his thing is because he's got a little bit of a gut for a young guy, he starts to raise his shirt, his tank top, and sort of caress his own tummy, making fun of himself, and the crowd goes wild. So there we go. We did reggaeton, Brazil funk, Duolingo, a little bit of London, and we'll get into the content. Might be in, Latvia, maybe Lithuania, possibly Prague for a conference. There's a few things coming up, but I'll let you know soon. All right. skim to some of these posts. So it's funny, I posted this Taylor Swift thing, and, you know, I do watch and pay attention to geopolitics. There's a part of the YouTube world which I do find quite interesting. It seems to mostly be these Central and Eastern European guys in their 20s who talk about Russia and Albania and Serbia and how the Ottoman Empire, but they do it in like a meme-like way, a shitposting kind of way. I'm sure they have politics that a lot of you might not like, or maybe me, but they're kind of interesting because they're just unhinged. And so I do spend a little bit of time around that world, and then there's the more serious political strategists. There's a YouTuber, Vlad Vexler, there's a geopolitical strategist. Is it Peter Zeihan? I listen to the All in One podcast quite often, or I'll watch it. And I can tell a lot of the personalities, you know, I don't know if I'm hanging out with them, but I think it's just interesting to hear some of their takes. If you believe, so, like a lot of them, China seems to be imploding. I've heard numbers from them having 100 million empty apartments to 1.5 billion empty apartments in China right now. Depopulating, or close to. South Korea is already depopulating. Anyway, I don't know. What have we done to the world? What have we done to each other? What do we keep doing to each other? It's just how we are, aren't we? I'm going to walk down to Bryant Park as I get into Taylor Swift. So I was thinking about the Taylor Swift conspiracy theory, which is pretty amazing. If you're interested in psychology, there's a guy who I think he's... There's a guy called Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T, and he's researched Aura a lot, and he pops up, he talks a lot about what's happening in the U.S. It is kind of weird when there's these people that you paid a lot of attention to, and then every now and then, and I don't know if it's him, I don't know if I'm remembering him correctly, I think he's in this group, but, you know, you might be really interested in someone, and then all of a sudden they pop out with, like, for me at least, forgive me if you're a far-right person, you're probably not listening to this if you are, and he's not, I'm not saying he is, but they'll just come out with, like, a little trope or a phrase or a concept from what you know is, like, a Russian talking point or something that seems like it's edging far-right, and I was like, oh, dude, stop. I don't like the left-right thing. I don't like it. The research that is the most useful is around how the Big Five personality traits correlates to quite a big degree to political beliefs, which is what I think that Cambridge saga was trying to take advantage of, getting people to self-profile so they work out how to target people who are susceptible to certain kinds of ideas. And you know that with the conservative world, one of their main goals is to cause... I guess it's like the outrage of unfairness. So you do see people like, you know, the Tucker Carlson's of the world talking about bread in Russia. Oh, they've got bread. No, I relate to that on one hand, because I don't think the food system in the US is very healthy. It's very food, health, everything here is very predatory-ish. People get away with what they can, try to make a buck in a big, big way. And it costs the country health. It's bad. But what a lot of these little, you know, like, hey, let me go through a supermarket and show you Russian bread. What they're trying to do is just cause outrage, because a lot of conservative people, they feel, from what I understand, they feel disgust more than other people. And that can even come down to smell. But if you think about it, conserve what? Conserve order. So if you're trying to appeal to people who want to conserve order, you point out how the order is broken, that causes a sense of disgust and outrage. But what they try to do is the outrage of unfairness. Like, oh, that's not fair that they've got that and I don't. I want that. You know, with the U.S., and that's why people get confused when there's research that comes out about a lot of recent immigrants in the U.S. being more conservative. And a lot of them are like, yeah, well, I came in the right way. They've got to get behind me in the line for the American dream. It's super interesting. So, the Taylor Swift conspiracy. I got to do these more often, and then I won't just dump a billion different thoughts on you. I'm diagonally across from the Bryant Park, from Bryant Park. The ice skating thing is still up. I don't know how long that lasts, because we're right near the end of February. I guess March is when spring starts, so maybe that disappears soon. And so I was thinking, you know, if Taylor Swift is a psyop on conservatives, what's the strategy? A psyop as in a psychological operation. Which to me is, it's about like a, propagandistic mindset trying to subvert, trying to manipulate a group of people through false facts. And a lot of, I was reading something today that a lot of conservatives believe that this particular conspiracy. I think 1 in 3 believe in the grand replacement conspiracy, which is that the Democrats want to bring in. And I'm not doing what you think I might be doing here. I'm not competing. I'm not joining a team. I'm not fighting for one team or another. I'm just talking about stuff that I see in the world, okay? Can't stand it. And I got to tell you, as I get older, I catch up with people and I'm like, their brains have been just 5% broken. And all of a sudden, instead of talking about fun stuff, Democrats. And I'm like, I don't want to talk about it. Just, I don't want to talk about it. I'll talk about ideas. Or who's trying to do what? That's interesting. I don't want to talk about that. Things you learn to say about your team. Don't care. Not yet. When I run for the, to be the first Australian mayor of New York City, oh, of course that's going to change, but I'll have to go independent, you know? I'm joking, it's not possible. So PSYOP is a psychological operation. I mean, the Russians are pretty good at this. And anytime you get a bit upset about another country, if you're in the US, the US has done all the things to all the countries, okay? Literally for hundreds of years, destroyed democracy, not destroyed democracies, but destroyed countries and leaderships. And think about all the drugs going on in the, like, all the drug problems happening in the world right now. You don't think the US could stop a lot of that? Come on. It's too much money to be made. Come on. That's not an anti-American comment. Chinese Mexicans are flooding the world with fentanyl right now. It's not an anti-Mexican or anti-Chinese comment. Okay. But if you're listening to this, I know that you know these things because you're not an idiot. I might be, but you're not. So the Taylor Swift conspiracy theory as a strategy. So I posted a lot of this stuff on Instagram, including a post that looked at that Financial Times research about how young men and young women are polarizing. Young men are becoming more conservative. Young women are becoming more progressive. Various reasons are suggested for it. Various points in time suggested as significant points of time for it, including the Me Too movement leading to women becoming more progressive and maybe men reacting a little bit against it. I believe in the US, at least the young men are having worse educational and economic outcomes, relatively speaking. Maybe relatively speaking to previous generations of men, but also relatively speaking, relative to women. Too excited. I'm excited. I'm not going to edit this either. You get all the excitement. And then there's also some research out there from Rawlings, Rawlings, and Childress or Childress. It's titled The Polarization of Popular Culture working paper. And increasingly, these groups of people are clustering in particular topics of interest. Could be, country singing. It's the stuff that intuitively you probably know, but it's just becoming more and more obvious. Now, if Taylor Swift is a conspiracy theory, we have to ask, well, for whom and to achieve what? So let's imagine there is some think tank. I'm making this up and I'm not into this. I'm making it up. Let's imagine there's some think tank and they're trying to push progressive ideas in the world. But, and they've seen some of that research that I just went through. Men are increasingly conservative. They're worried about the upcoming US elections or elections everywhere. Their business issue is essentially that, at least in the US, the USA in parts, is becoming more conservative. What are the costs on that? Well, if you have progressive ideals, or especially if you're a woman or someone who doesn't identify as a man, that could cost you a lot, like human rights. A lot of chat this week about IVF and abortion can constantly in the US. Who has the right to make decision for women? Does it have to continually be 89-year-old men, white Christian men? And no offense if you're Christian, but could we just not do this? Can we stop? So I try to dig into the problem. If the starting point is that this group of people are becoming more conservative, and we'll say the symptom is there's a rise in conservatism in men. One of the theories is that young men are spending less time with women who typically quote-unquote socialize them. That some of these concepts are just they are a little bit problematic, very much normative. The idea that a woman has to socialize a man, like, what does that even mean? Is something, awkward. I'm not a PhD in the area, so I don't have all the language or the tools. But one of the theories is there's a rise in conservatism partly because men are spending less time with people who are different from them, especially women. More time online, not even in certain places, like less guys are going to college, not that college is the only thing to be in life. And so digging into the problem, not going to read it all out, but essentially we arrive at something. So I'm not super happy with it. It's okay. That this problem that conservatives are gatekeeping alpha world from progressive ideas. It's more of a symptom. It's not like a why. As soon as we get into this topic, there's battles in like the comments about all kinds of stuff. You kind of predict it. But obviously you would say that a lot of men have a reason to not change because they benefit from the way that the world has been. This is sort of an insight. Oh, it's so weird reading this stuff out when I'm not like fully convinced by it. Insight, when you can't get through the alpha gates, you can surround them. Advantage, this, I'm doing the 4 points. Advantage, alphas need women to prove they're alpha. And someone's like, oh, we don't need women. This alpha guy's like, oh, we don't need women to prove we're alpha. And I'm like, pretty sure historically speaking, that was what it was about. That the alpha got access to women. And if you look at any research on evolutionary psychology, we tend to do things for three reasons. Access to resources, status, and access to mating opportunities. So to say that that is not correct when it's not that interesting, that'd be a better thing to say. You didn't write that well, that'd hurt more. But to say it's not correct, that's not useful. And so maybe there's a strategy of planting progressive culture in alpha world by women, maybe by alpha women, I don't know. It's not my strongest 4 points, but a little bit of fun. It was great to see the reaction to it. So the other reason that I wanted to sort of lay out the 4 points like that is to then separate Taylor Swift as an idea from all of that. Because tactic one could be, like, if this was your PSYOP and you're in charge of it, you might go, like, tactic one could be, let's look at places where it's very conservative and very alpha male. So you just, I said to say it three times and the words came out. Very man, very what? Men, very alpha male. So when you start to get into the categories of strategy versus tactics versus idea, there's a little bit of back and forth because I could say tactic one is to get into areas which are nearly exclusively male. Or perhaps the strategist says, you know what? We're going to target the NFL. That's going to be one of our three, if it's three big tactics. So we're going to say seduce the NFL is tactic one, if that's even what they're doing. Now, there is an idea that comes off that tactic, which is about, you know, Taylor Swift and I said Trevor Kelce because I knew what his name was, but I rush and then sometimes there's an autocorrect going on or I mistype something and then I published. Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce has an idea, and you know, these big stars get together. So that's one way to look at that. Reading it out, I don't know. I might do more of these conspiracy theories as strategy, though. So I've had a few people on the various social platforms suggest that I do. I've also been trying to respond to a few questions on Instagram, and one of them came from illusion_demystified. It was about explaining insights to creatives. How do you explain insights to creatives? One common strategy problem is when something like an insight that's on a creative brief doesn't appear in the work or doesn't seem to affect the work, or two, when there might be an insight, unless I would say 80% of briefs don't have these things in a very meaningful way. If you want me to be kind, I'll say 75%, okay?
Made this baby.
But it's super weird when I'm doing these things and people just walk past talking really loudly. You couldn't hear it, but it just my brain just glitched. I think I get defensive. I'm like, what's about to happen? So if I'm recording these things, holding a mic to my mouth, just give me some space. I'm getting anxious. I'm an anxious little sad boy. So the other second thing is when if you do have something that's useful as an insight that the creative team goes, yeah, whatever, and then they come back and present the work and go, here's my insight. But I'll tell you this. If strategists are feeling these things, you're not going to, it's difficult to explain your way through a creative team as it is difficult to explain your way into and through anything. We have to start with what these words mean. A lot of you will have heard me talk about this before. I'd say in a very secular way that an insight in advertising is an unspoken human truth. It's about people reveal something unusual, uncommon about them. But the way that it works in advertising, as far as I believe, is that it draws people into a brand. You thought the world was like this, but it's actually like this, and you're like this, and you're like, oh, okay. That's one main category of how an insight can work. Probably the most important one. When I'm teaching the 4 points, I will talk about how I want to see the insight open up the problem. Open up is a little esoteric, it's a bit weird, but open up the problem where the problem is the barrier, the obstacle in the way of people doing something. We also have to acknowledge that insights are ideas, I believe. I keep seeing stuff online on LinkedIn and Instagram. People are fighting the algorithms. They're like, don't think about strategy as being creative. And so, like, well, what are we even talking about? What kind of strategy? What do you mean by creative? And that's why I'm not like anal about definitions. I'm just like, here's how I use the words. You can use them however you want to. But if we're going to have a conversation, it helps for us to understand how we're using the words. And then we can work better together. That's the point. So the example I use here on Instagram is, if insights are ideas and ideas combine topics in new ways to create new meaning. We could have topic one being this, strategists study the world. So strategists studying the world, strategists study the world, topic one. And then in the middle, I'd put a word like because. Topic two, strategists are scared to know themselves. So strategists study the world because strategists are scared to know themselves. That might or might not be true to you. But it carries the structure and the energy of what I look for when I'm trying to either find or write an insight. We want to have this reaction to an insight. Oh, that's so true, and I haven't heard it before. I like that. And then when they work on us, they make us change. So insights are ideas that get us to change how we behave. So if you're just thinking, you know, no one pays attention to my insights, do you even have them? Do you have them? Are you writing them? And I'm not saying that in a way to make fun of you. It's just sometimes when we complain, I'm talking to myself here a little bit. When we complain, we have to examine ourselves first. We don't want to gaslight ourselves. We don't want to be participants in our own misery like that. But just, you know, did I do something to contribute to this that I can learn from? Now, when it comes to the process, though, the creative teams, let's say you've got a really awesome creative brief. There's like an insight the way I'm describing it and a strategy that has some kind of flip, some reframe that's, oh my God, that's also amazing and I didn't see that coming. The creatives are usually going to want to do at least one or two extra steps and then go, here's my idea. They might use the word springboard or stimulus or stimuli or insight. You know, they're trying to get to their own little epiphany. So haven't even thought this one through. Let me bring up this language again. So strategists study the world because strategists just get to know themselves. Part of the creative process, we'll put that in the middle of a page, mentally or physically. And then a mind map would go, what do I associate with that? Strategists study the world because strategists are scared to know themselves, okay? So school, we study things for school, exams, travel, we travel the world, magnifying glass, we just start to like make random associations. And they might go, you know what, that insight or that, maybe it's a strategy statement that's very similar to the one that I read out for the insight. They're like, oh, you know, that reminds me of like, exams. And then I thought about exams and that reminded me about like studying at the last minute and waiting for the surge of energy to happen. And that reminded me of this. And then that led us to this idea. So they might say there was this and then this, and I went deeper and I went deeper and then I went deeper and then boom, that's the idea. Now, if they're using the word insight to describe that, yet you're working internally with a client and you've agreed on insights to go into a brief, then what they're doing is muddying things. Okay, but in a way it is a creative insight. They're trying to dig in and dig in and then a twist and then a turn and boom, and all of a sudden this idea comes out and you're like, oh my God, I didn't even see that coming. And I thought we loaded up this brief with like interesting stuff. So you want these behaviors to happen. The way through it is just to talk about the language that you're using, try to clarify the language you're using, and try to work well together. Listen, it's not always easy though. Final thing I'll get into now, and I hope the sound of this has been okay because I'm literally standing next to buses, Mr. Bryant Park. Thank you for your messages. I don't mind getting the short messages. I don't say that with any arrogance. I appreciate it. Questions about life and career and all those kinds of things. It's a little bit awkward when people send me like 1,000 word histories of their lives and then a CV and a portfolio. And they're like, what do you think? Whoever you do that to, it's not a good user experience. Let's put it that way. But I did get a message this morning, which I've had before. It was from someone who's had very, very, very big and famous jobs in companies, brands that I think a lot of you would want to work in. And they had told me, keep privacy, they told me that they were told when they just lost their job recently that the company, it's not an agency, the company just didn't need strategy anymore. And they heard that on their way out of their last company as well. So I was like, well, what does we don't need strategy here mean? And I think there's at least eight things that it can mean. The first is we just don't want to pay for strategy. There's a ton of financial pressure on companies right now. But
can you hear that? I'll point the microphone towards the audience.
Oh, no, blur.
Walking back to Times Square might actually be quieter.
There's just a ton of pressure everywhere right now. I'm seeing on LinkedIn and in my DMs, it feels like it's like another round of layoffs. Like maybe, is it fair to say two this year, little rounds? We had the media companies about a month ago. I'm hearing that a bunch of agencies have laid people off. Every day there's stuff coming out. I saw some screenwriters talking about this stuff on X or Twitter about how, you know, there was a strike last year and quote unquote Hollywood, so a lot of things weren't happening. Writer strike, a lot of things weren't being made. And now this year, from what I understand, a lot of the streaming platforms, at the very least, are not planning to make as much stuff as they did before. It's all about increasing margin, probably raising prices and trying to exploit their existing library. So there's less stuff being made. And the screenwriters were saying, yeah, it's hard to get work right now. The theme seems to be survive until 2025. Who knows if 2025 will be better or worse, but I think it points to a nice phrase to remember, a mood, just to keep things a bit tight this year. If you work in a similar space as I do, I think you still got to be creative, express, get yourself into public a little bit so you've got a reputation for when things hopefully get better. I think it's going to be hard if you are a little bit older. Sorry. I think if you're over 40, 45, and I know I'm playing into a stereotype, I've talked about this before, I've seen some data. One of the biggest trends in the past 2 years in the US, looking at some research from the 4As, is how much more of the advertising workforce is younger. So we hear these two kinds of stories, hard to get in, hard to get back in, but also it's younger, which is a way to be cheaper. Now, if you're running companies and running agencies, you have to do that. Otherwise, the company goes bust. If the CEOs are earning $50, $100 million or whatever it is, I just made up big numbers for the sake of it, they're too big. And then they're firing all the mid-level people. That sucks. That's hard to really stomach.
And I don't always do it.
Look at here. Let me continue with where I was. So we don't want to pay for strategy. Number two could be we don't want to pay what we're paying you for strategy. Again, instead of like a big salary, if you're a senior strategist, I don't mean senior strategist as in the title, but someone who's been around for a long time doing strategy. It's hard for in a lot of places, it's hard for strategy to get traction. Therefore, why are people going to pay for it? Therefore, if you need it, but you need just a little bit of it, you bring in someone more junior. Three, we just can't afford you anymore. Similar to two, but I think it's a little bit different. Four, strategy is what another department does. So if you work with a lot of MBAs or serious product people, a lot of them, or even like if the agency dynamics are a little bit different, where you might have strategists in the media company really dominating the brand more than the creative agencies, sometimes people are like, why do we need another strategist? Like, we already got the strategy. Now, who knows what that word means? But when all these different people use it, they could be talking about a business strategy or a product strategy or a brand strategy, or are they're not talking about advertising or social media necessarily.
I mean, what's good?
We don't even know what strategy is, but it's not what you're doing. I've sensed this a little bit. There's been a lot of kind of agencies that have added strategists that didn't used to have them. I'll point a finger at UPR agencies. And then strategists and creative directors will go in and they're like, oh no, I don't know. What are we paying for this for? I do that. I'm the PR person. I do strategy. Very, very common. There's no diss on PR people, by the way. I've seen it up close. I've heard it up close. I have people in my DMs every month going through that. Six, you know, because of the explosion of channels and where the algorithms are flipping and flopping and multivariate testing, etc., there's a little bit of a, let's just throw a lot of stuff at the wall, see what sticks. Therefore, we don't have to think too much. The algorithms will tell us. The data will tell us. So what do we need a strategist for? Seven, you strategist, you slowed us down and made everything complicated. I see a lot of strategy that is just overwrought, too much thinking. We're over-engineering scopes. I think a lot of strategy that gets done and sold in, it doesn't necessarily need to happen in all those workshops. I think you could be much more direct. And I think the strategists who are more pragmatic, who are able to get to things directly, and I'm not talking about not doing research. I'm not talking about just making stuff up. and being reckless. I'm talking about working out how to use research, but in a really pragmatic way, and then potentially being involved beyond the strategy, especially if you're involved with social media. You got to be close to the implementation of things and or close to money revenue. If you're not, you become very quickly a nice to have. And number eight could be, we just don't like you. Or the eight things that we don't want or need strategy here. So eight things that could all mean.
If you're going through some tough times right now, always hugs. It's not easy.
It's not easy. I've lost a few jobs. .com, lost two in the US. Leobinet closed after I joined it a month later. We're closing the office in New York. I was head of strategy at Edelman. People could not get traction. They closed. I was told it was not a culture fit. I wasn't happy. I met good people there. But I have really good people, including a lot of the people who were still in the strategy world. But the business itself, I would run workshops and I would say, I'm giving you my problem, which is no one wants to pay for strategists. And I had no one reporting into me, really. So no power. The strategists that were there, they would put it into the business unit people. I was like, I don't know how to attraction because you want to use me, pitch, or if client threatens to leave, but then if we win the pitch or if we keep the client and not putting any hours on the strategist, allocating any hours to strategy, and yet that's my fault. Doesn't make any sense. I have people coming to my desk at 4 p.m. saying, we need an insight by 5 p.m. The boss told me to come down. Super weird. It's a good, it's a good company, very effective and a successful company, and I've met a lot of good people. I'm not dissing it. Don't sue me. Again, work with people in that company now, good friends there. But I'm saying that not to ping that situation. I ignored one of my main red flags when I took that job, which I've talked about before without mentioning who it was. And I kicked myself for a very long time. I was depressed. We go home just depressed. I was like, I don't know how to make this work because I feel like I'm literally being gaslit. I'm saying this not to ping, because not sue me, but a lot of you are going through it. A lot of you have gone into PR agencies. You've gone through it. I got people in my DMs this week who are going through it. And they're like, I thought I don't care what I did and I just can't get traction. PR world's very tough, but so is the business world if they don't get what we do. And that's why I think there's a very strong argument, which is not my argument, that if you want to have a good little pocket of a career, consider trying to get into where this stuff really, really works. I bought into we need a game changer, not a game changer. Was it a change agent for whatnot? But I was sick of dealing with creative teams. I used to make magazines and put on events and distribute music. And I was just used to doing stuff. And then I would just get sick of the mood of a lot of people and the arrogance of some people, not all. And how long it took. People would complain about $100,000 budget. I'm like, dude, that I could put on an event for $300. Like, what are you complaining about? And I got tired of it and needed to take more responsibility for my own expression. All right. So I say all that with love. We're dropping lots of links, the ebooks, lots of good ebooks. You get it? Get Instagram and you can find all that stuff. Trying to create a lot of things, do some videos, do more reels. Hope you're doing okay out there. And also hope to see you in one of our events, whether it's paid or free, coming up soon. You can find details at sweathead.com. Peace.